Welcome, everyone, to episode 17 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing good, man. You know what? I really like that opening theme song, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially, you know, I think most people that listen to either, you know, our original podcast, True Crime All the Time, and this one, they know we record mostly on Friday nights. And we typically record this one after True Crime All the Time. So that's a pretty upbeat intro, man. And it seems to give me a second wind. I really enjoy it.
You get your second wind on that?
I do, yeah.
There are some people think that you had something to do with that one and just said, you know, just make it just like the first one, but put some sweet guitar licks in.
Yeah.
I've seen people say that.
And we did.
And that's what we did.
That's what we did.
All right, so let's start out. We got to give some love to our Patreon supporters. Jess Huey, Christine Hernandez, Bethany Gabrielle. And Bethany's actually supporting us at our highest Patreon level. So, you know, we definitely appreciate that. And we actually had Nate Abraham supported us on PayPal. So we love everyone. We thank you for the support.
That's awesome, guys.
The new supporters, as well as the people that have been supporting us from the beginning, it means so much to us. Thank you, thank you. So, Gibbs, we're just going to jump right in, man.
Yeah, I think people, some folks have not listened to part one, anticipating part two, so they can just kind of roll it and keep going.
Yeah.
Kind of binge listen.
There are people that like to hear part one and part two together. So, just a quick recap, not a recap, but where we ended off in part one, we're talking about the Phantom Killer, Texarkana. And we ended part one talking about the attack on the Starks, right? Virgil was killed. Katie Starks survived. There are some people, Gibbs, that don't believe that this attack on the Starks is connected with the other double murders.
Yeah, you're right, Mike, because a 32 caliber Colt handgun was used in the other murders. In this case, it was a 22 caliber rifle. So the first murders, you know, those were after midnight, where the Starks was earlier in the evening. So I think that's where some of the comparisons are coming in at. Different gun, different time of day.
So I get you, Gibbs. I think there are some differences that people point out between the double murders in the Lover's Lane scenario versus the incident at the Starks' house. There are some differences. So I think that's why a lot of people think that it may not be the Phantom that attacked the Starks. All right, but in part two, right, we're going to talk about rumors, we're going to talk about suspects, and we're going to wrap it up into a bow. So let's start with some rumors. There were a lot. They were spreading like wildfire.
Which you can imagine, during this time, short period of time, so many, in a small community, so many people were dying. Pretty scary.
So by May, Gibbs, there's rumors that are being spread all over town. Like wildfire, right? There are a lot of people that think the Phantom Killer has already been caught.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they think the Texas Rangers swarmed into town and located them and have housed them in a jail.
There's another rumor floating out there that he was caught, but they flew him to an out-of-town jail because they were afraid some angry mob was going to come after him. And you got to think back at this time, right? We're talking 1946. People were in a state of panic. The newspapers were just getting bombarded with phone calls. And not just from local citizens. I mean, there were long distance phone calls from all over the country because this was national. It doesn't go as quick as it does today in today's news cycle, but this was a national story.
Oh, absolutely.
So there were people calling from all around the country asking about the apprehension of the killer. They had to go as far as publishing in the newspaper a huge headline that said, newspapers will tell if killer is caught. So again, rumors. They're trying to dispel so many different rumors. And if you go back to part one, the sheriff comes out and says, we'll tell the papers, and the papers will print what is true.
Right.
That was a big thing.
Sure.
That doesn't satisfy the people.
No, to the point the sheriff has to make another statement.
Yeah, because I think what was happening was that there were a whole bunch of innocent people being accused of being the Phantom Killer.
Right.
And so the statement that he puts out is that, you know, none of these rumors are true. We can understand why the people believe them. You know, everyone is tense, and we're hopeful that any hour officers will announce that they have the killer in custody. The people must not become so anxious to rid themselves of the killer, however, that they brand innocent persons as the murderer and believe unfounded stories. The investigating officers have announced that when and if the killer is apprehended or killed, the public will be given the full story through the newspapers. We reaffirm this statement. So again, he's basically modified, but making a very similar statement to what he made months earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's trying to calm the panic.
Well, let's talk about that panic, because it was real. And I think it started after the first double murder, right? I mean, you had parents warning their children about being out late. We talked about it in the first episode. I still had a hard time believing that in the 1940s, there were, you know, people as young as
15, 16,
just out at midnight, 1 o'clock.
Yeah. No curfew.
Yeah. I thought that was strange for the 1940s, but there were, because they were being killed.
Yeah.
Out on Lover's Lane.
Yeah. They were there. They were out.
And then you have the second double murder that shocked the city even more, and it caused curfews to be set, right? They even had, and not just for people. I mean, they had curfews set for businesses. So businesses were closing at a certain time. That's how much panic was going on in the streets. And then you had the murder of Virgil Stark. And the papers, you know, they were supposed to report the truth, right? What the police were telling them. But they have to post something. It is a newspaper, and they're trying to get readers, and they're trying to sell newspapers. So they post on Sunday, May the 5th, that the killer might attack again at any moment, any place, any time, anyone. So I don't know how, Gibbs, that's helping to alleviate any panic or calm people down.
Yeah, I don't think it is.
When you're putting in the paper that, you know, watch out, this guy's going to kill any of you at any time.
Yeah, I think it actually just increased anxiety.
It had to.
And to the point that I even read that there was some, I don't know if you want to call it, or use the word vigilante, but people were parking in Lover's Lane armed, hoping that the Phantom would approach the car and they were ready to shoot him. Or there was even one story where somebody actually parked a vehicle with mannequins in it and were hiding in bushes with shotguns, hoping that the Phantom would pull up, approach the vehicle. So I mean, just bizarre how some people reacted to this and how they thought they could solve it by just putting themselves at risk in one sense, right? And the other one with, you know, actually doing the mannequin in the car. I mean, this, it was just bizarre times.
So trying to be hero. Somebody wanted to be the person that stopped the Phantom.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that's a pretty risky move.
So in the same story, they talk about how the police walked up on one of the vehicles and the female in the car had her .22 in her lap and was almost ready to shoot the police officer that came up on her.
Got to arm yourself. Got to protect yourself. So, Gibbs, I think back then, and even much later than this, there was large parts of America where it was very normal to leave your house unlocked during the day, when you slept. That was a normal thing. I mean, nobody does that today because the world's gone crazy. But this phantom killer thing, it had residents locking their doors. And like you said, people were arming themselves with guns. I can imagine that the gun sales in that area skyrocketed. But I think the point is that people were taking all kinds of different precautions. I mean, they were going, not just locking their doors. I mean, they were going as far as nailing the window shut. I mean, it was even said, Gibbs, that stores sold out of locks, guns, ammunition.
Yeah, I'm sure they had to drive to other counties to get some weapons and ammunition at that point.
We talked about the newspapers being inundated with phone calls. But the other thing that happened was that the police were inundated with phone calls. Because again, everybody's calling the police at the drop of a hat, right? You got somebody walking around, that's suspicious. I'm calling the police. Prowlers. You know, somebody walking their dog. That's the phantom killer. That's what you had happening. Also, along with what we talked about, where every Tom, Dick, and Harry was accusing their neighbor of being the phantom killer, or if you had a grudge against somebody, that's the phantom killer.
Yeah, I mean, it had to be crazy. Hysteria everywhere, you know? I mean, just people.
Right. Husband cheated on his wife. His wife calls and says, I think my husband's the phantom killer.
Yeah. Kids calling in their teachers, you know?
And it was stated by police officers that none of this stuff was checking out. All of the calls and all of the accusations, nothing was checking out. It was just a result of hysteria and, you know, people's over-imagination, I'll say.
And I'm guessing it probably had an economic impact on the community. I mean, if you're afraid to go out at nighttime because you might be the next victim, you know what? You're not going to support your local diner, your local cafes, your, you know, clubs, whatever they had back in the day.
Well, no, I think you're right, because it was said that businesses reported huge declines in sales, especially those that make most of their money at night, right? Like you said, cafes, theaters, nightclubs, things like that. Yeah. I mean, it was like a ghost town after a certain time of night. People were home. They had their doors locked. Everything was boarded up, and they were sitting in their chair with the shotgun.
Yeah.
That's what I'm picturing.
What was the name of the movie?
The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah. There you go. Sundown went down, man. Everybody stayed home and away.
Sundown went down. Down.
Sundown went
Sundown
down.
Sundown went down. So there was one liquor store that posted a statement in their window, and I have to read it because I got a kick out of it, Gibbs. It says, "We fully understand the state of mind in which Texarkana is now gripped, and we are selling no liquor to persons who already have been drinking. We do not wish to add further to the troubles of the police. Any person who drinks whiskey at this time to get drunk and wander about the streets of Texarkana is further complicating the works of the police and is placing himself in grave danger of being shot by people whose nerves are on edge from the recent murders."
It's probably a good thing.
It is, but it's what cracks me up about it is, can you just imagine walking up to the liquor store and reading that statement in the window?
That'd be funny.
I
you know, there's probably that one drunkard, man, that finds a potato sack, thinks it's funny to put it on his head, kind of wander around middle of the street like he's the phantom killer, you know? So, you know.
I don't know. I feel like he would have been shot pretty quick.
Yeah.
But, you know, we joke about it, but in all reality, Texarkana became a very, very dangerous place. Not from the phantom killer, because we know, Gibbs, that there were no more murders attributed to the phantom killer. But what became dangerous is all the people in Texarkana scared to death that the Phantom Killer was going to strike again. I mean, it was said that police officers were so nervous that they had to turn on their sirens when they drove up somewhere just to let people know that, hey, we're the police.
Yeah, don't shoot.
That's the kind of state of affairs that we're talking about. And, you know, not just the police. I mean, it trickled down to, you know, everyone. You just didn't drive over to somebody's house and knock on their door. I mean, you had to, at some point, call them and say, in advance, I'm coming to your house. So when you hear the knock on the door, it's me. It's not the Phantom Killer. Please do not shoot me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you had to be extremely, extremely careful to the point. I even read that somebody going to a bar walked in unannounced and the bartender owner shot him in the foot. He just wanted a drink.
So was he a horrible shot or did he just decide he was going to scare him?
I think maybe he was just a horrible, maybe he'd been drinking all day.
So Gibbs, the police captain, comes out on the radio and makes this announcement that says all Texarkanians should oil up their guns and make sure they're loaded. Do not use them unless it's necessary, but if you think it is, don't hesitate. This is the police captain basically saying, make sure you're armed, be careful, but don't hesitate to shoot somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine hearing that?
Yeah.
You know, so he was asked at one point what advice he could give to alleviate the fear going on in the town. And he said, I'd tell them to check the locks and bolts on their doors and get a double-barreled shotgun to take care of any intruder who tried to get in. Well, I agree with that advice.
Yeah.
But
the other part.
But it's just mass hysteria. Right. I don't know what else to call it.
So on top of all that, then you have the killer being known as the Phantom, which is kind of ominous.
But no, I think there's something to that, Gibbs, because again, once you give something a nickname, and especially a scary nickname, I mean, it's scary enough that you have a killer on the loose. But when you start to name it some name that evokes even more fear, there's something to that.
Sure. To a point, it even caused a lot of the local residents to buy dogs for, you know, determined to guard dogs. They wanted to be alerted when someone came onto their property, right? So, you know, there was a huge demand for any dog, but more so guard dog types, right? And then people were also kind of booby trapping their property. So if someone came onto the property at nighttime, that they would, you know, injure themselves.
So they were going like full Charles Bronson death wish.
Yeah, death wish like, you know. And then you have people that just said, you know what, this is crazy. Until this guy's caught or something's been resolved, we're moving out. We're going to go stay at a hotel. We're going to go stay with some relatives in another county. We'll come back at a later date. So you had all that going on as well.
Now, we talked a lot about in the first episode how many people were questioned as suspects. And that keeps on going. Anybody that the police thought was even the slightest bit suspicious, they got questioned. There was a lot of questioning going on. So one thing we haven't talked about, Gibbs, is, you know, the papers are putting out all this information. There's news going out. And it does start to, like we said, go much further than Texarkana, obviously, national. But what happens is this fear that's gripping Texarkana starts to spread. Right? Because they haven't caught this person. They don't know who it is. They don't know where they are. And it spreads into a bunch of other neighboring cities. So then you have like this almost like a waterfall effect where they're starting to experience some of the same things. And it goes as far as like Oklahoma City.
Yeah. And I could see that. I mean, we even see that today. So we did a story not too long ago about the Oakland County child killer. And even on that story, we talked about how people would play in the streets and you didn't worry about your kids and you didn't, you know, even back then they weren't really locking all the doors. But when that happened, the town tightened up really fast. But even up there in Michigan where this occurred, where we were in Dayton, we started locking our doors. We were hearing about this stuff and there was a little, there was somewhat of a panic, right? Because it didn't catch the person.
Right.
So,
and that was the late 70s.
Yeah. So this is, you know, this is just a trend that happens in this, these terrible times. It's not unlikely that this is going to, it's going to keep spreading, I think, as people hear about it because they're concerned until they catch whoever has done this terrible stuff.
Well, to the point where even in these other cities, they were doing similar things, right? They were stocking up on guns and other types of weapons. But something happened as time went on because there were no more murders. So the fear begins to drop a little bit every couple weeks, right? You go a week, 2 weeks, no murders. You go another couple weeks, there's no murders.
Right.
So the fear level drops slowly, slowly, slowly.
Sure. So that's one interesting thing I find about humans is that we forget fairly quickly about certain events. And I think in this case, if you're not hearing about it anymore, you forget and you think it's all been taken care of. Even if you don't have proof of it, you assume it has and you go, your life goes back to normal.
I think you're absolutely right, Gibbs, because there are a lot of things that you know, you hear on the news or that scare you. You know, there's a killer on the loose or somebody killed somebody. But at some point, when you don't hear about it anymore, it kind of goes away, right? It's like out of sight, out of mind.
Absolutely.
It's scary. It's scary. I'm starting to forget about it. And eventually, I don't even remember what it was I was scared about.
Yeah. If they're not talking about that scary name anymore, the Phantom Killer, you know, you're going to forget about it.
Well, and as the fear starts to subside in Texarkana, you know, one thing that happens is at some point the Texas Rangers kind of pull out. Not all at once, but little by little, the presence of the Texas Rangers becomes smaller and smaller. And eventually, they just kind of leave.
Yeah, I mean, if the resources aren't needed there anymore, I'm sure they're needed elsewhere. So,
now, this was not publicized. The papers didn't announce it because they didn't want the Phantom Killer to think, oh, I'm free to do whatever I want.
Yeah, but if you're a local resident and you see the Texas Rangers around town a lot and all of a sudden you don't see them around like you did, well, I would think that you would feel like, well, it's okay now. If they feel that they can leave, they must assume that we're all going to be safe.
Yeah, I would agree. Right?
But it's still freaky, the name, the Phantom Killer.
Well, and one thing we haven't talked, we didn't talk about because we were saving it. We didn't talk about it in part one was it didn't start out being the Phantom Killer, obviously. And that's true with all of these cases, solved or unsolved. You know, serial killers don't get their nickname in the beginning.
Right.
Right. That comes.
Yeah, they acquire it down the path.
Yeah, that. You know, it's given to them through the media, but it takes a while. And with the Phantom Killer, that didn't come out until after the death of Betty Jo Booker and Paul Martin. And it came out in the April 16th edition of the Texarkana Daily News. And it was a big heading that read, "Phantom Killer Eludes Officers as Investigation of Slayings Pressed." Right, so that was the headline. And really what I take away from that is that a Phantom Killer, meaning unknown, But I think somehow that got transformed or it morphed into being the Phantom Killer. Well, not to be outdone, the Texarkana Gazette, they go on the very next day with Phantom Slayer still at large as probe continues. So that's why I think you see this both as the Phantom Killer and the Phantom Slayer. To me, I think it started out as being more as Phantom, we don't know who this is. We touched on this a little bit in part one, but let's talk about descriptions of the killer. So you had the victims of the first attack, Jimmy Hollis and Mary Jean Larry. They were the only people to give a description of the attacker. They described the person as being 6 feet tall, with a white mask over his face, holes cut out for the eyes and mouth. Now, again, there were some differing opinions between Hollis and Larry. You know, Hollis believed that it was a dark, tanned, young white male under 30 years old. Larry believed it was a light-skinned African-American. And again, Gibbs, there was only one other surviving victim, and that was Katie Starks, but she never saw the person that attacked Virgil and herself.
So we really don't know if this Phantom wore a mask during the other ones. It was just an assumption that he did wear a mask. But because there's no survivors, there's no way to know.
There's no way to know.
Yeah.
But what I will say is the mask is scary.
Yeah, and I think that mask has really attached itself to the case.
Well, take a look at the pictures, or, you know, think back to the movie or the still pictures from the movie.
Yeah.
That's pretty damn scary.
Yeah.
To think of that person. Now, they described it as a white mask. I think it's often portrayed as more of a burlap, which is, you know, like a tannish color is what I think of.
Potato sack.
Yeah, potato sack type thing. But either way.
But if you think about that, this story, if you take that out of the equation, I don't think it's just not as scary. It's something about a mask over somebody's face. And maybe it's just the way that I was raised up with all everything in TV media, right? Some scary stuff when someone hides their face.
No, that's why even fictional killers oftentimes wear masks. It does make it more scary. I mean, if you think of Jason with the hockey mask, if you think of Michael Myers with that white, I mean, that thing is,
yeah,
you know, that's like the modern day version of the Phantom mask, if you think about it.
Right. Yeah. And even in other true crime activities, right, with, you know, one of your passionate cases, the Zodiac. I mean, he even wears a mask.
Yeah, very, very similar. Not burlap, but, you know, a mask with eyes cut out. Definitely. So, Gibbs, we got to talk about the profile of the killer. And we have to keep in mind that this is 1946. I don't believe they had, you know, like a full FBI profiling unit. That came much later. And so what we really had was Captain Gonzalez would come out and state that this was a very shrewd criminal who had left no stone unturned to conceal his identity and activities, and that his efforts were both clever and baffling. All right. I don't know if that's a profile so much as it is a statement.
Well, clever and baffling. You just covered everything from A to Z, didn't you?
Yeah, it's kind of very broad.
Yeah.
If we think about a profile in today's terms, it's much more specific.
Yeah, I think back then to do any type of analysis on the killer, the suspect, would be pretty difficult. I mean, you could throw out some common sense statements, but anything other than that, you know, I don't think anybody in this town was an expert on killers, let alone serial killers.
No, because, you know, he would even come out and say This is a cunning individual who would go to all lengths to avoid apprehension. Okay, well, you just described most criminals.
Yeah, I don't know anybody.
Not everybody's cunning, but...
Right. I don't think there's any criminal out there that wants to be caught. So, of course, they're going to do anything they can to avoid being caught.
I think we might have touched on this in part one, and I actually saw a newspaper that read sex maniac, right? They described this killer as a sex maniac. And this kind of happened after the murder of Virgil Starks. And it was said that the majority of the Rangers and the police and everybody involved, you know, although they wouldn't come out and say it officially, I think they, most of them believed that the motives behind the killings were that of what they termed sex mania, you know, so sexually related. Now, there was one officer that came out and said that he believed that this was the result of a sex pervert. So there was some interesting things that came out, Gibbs, from a psychologist named Dr. Anthony LaPala. And he believed that the killer was planning to continue to make unexpected attacks similar to the one on the Starks, right? On the outskirts of town. And he believed that it was the same person that murdered Virgil Starks, Betty Jo Booker, Paul Martin, Polly Ann Moore, and Richard Griffin. So very different than kind of what we said at the beginning of the episode, right? There were some people that thought that the murder of Virgil Starks and the attack on Katie Starks was somebody totally separate than the person that had committed what I'll call the Lover's Lane murders.
Right.
But this psychologist did not think that. You know, now here we get into what is what I consider more of a profile. The psychologist thought that the killer was between the ages of 30 to 50 years old. A little broad, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely broad, but...
He did think that the killer was motivated by a strong sex drive and that he was a sadist.
I believe that.
Yeah, I believe that too. But again, I think you and I could have come up with both of those.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that's... I just don't think any of that is groundbreaking. But again, we're talking 1946... An FBI profiler today, they would have a much more robust profile, I guess.
Well, they have more data to compare it to.
Yeah,
well, don't
you're
they?
Right. Now, one of the theories that the psychologist had was that he believed that the killer knew at all times what was going on in the investigation and that he was very familiar with all of the back roads that were being patrolled. And this is why I think he thought the house of Virgil and Katie Starks was chosen. So the psychologist goes on to say that this is a person probably leading a very normal life, appearing to others to be a good citizen. And Gibbs, I mean, that's something that we see in cases all the way up to today, right?
Right.
You have people that by all appearances are leading what I would consider a normal life. They just have this whole other side to them that for a while they're able to keep hidden, right? That's where we talk about, you know, somebody that's able to do horrible things, put a body in their freezer in the basement,
yeah,
walk upstairs, have dinner with their family. That happens.
Oh, yeah.
You and I have talked about a number of cases just like that. I don't think any of that is earth-shattering, but it's interesting to see what was, or to hear what was said and thought back in 1946, or what passed for what I would call clinical analysis. Now, the one thing that he said that I did think was really interesting is he said that he didn't think that it was that the killer was necessarily from that community. He thought it was very possible that the killer could be from, you know, another town, but be very acquainted with the area. Right? Because he did say he thought he knew all the back roads and he was very familiar with what was going on. But then to say that he could be, you know, from another town, that to me is interesting because obviously that makes the person harder to catch, right?
Well, you just, yeah, you expand the geographical location, of course, yeah.
All right, Gibby, I think we got to get into suspects. And, you know, for us, this is oftentimes the most interesting part of the unsolved cases.
Rabbit holes.
Because you got rabbit holes. But we've talked about the number of suspects a little bit, right? Throughout this investigation, it would end up being over 400.
That's a lot of suspects.
I don't know what they were calling a suspect. You know, anybody they talked to, because it seemed like they talked to a lot of people.
I think you might have had a revolving door. A lot of people coming in, sitting down, being interviewed, a little pressure put on them, and then they probably weren't held too long before they were back out.
Yeah, well, and the other thing I think that you see in this case is after each killing or after each incident, there's a lot of suspects, right? There's more suspects because the pressure is ratcheting up to apprehend this person. Because in the Hollis Larry case, there were no suspects apprehended. So then when you get to the Griffin and Moore case, there were over 200 people questioned and probably about the same number of false tips and leads that police had to check into. Now, there were three suspects taken into custody, and we touched on this in part one, because they had bloody clothing.
Right.
You know, two of them released very quickly because they were able to give alibis or satisfactory answers to all the questions. And they had that one suspect that was held for further questioning, but he was later freed as well. Now, when it comes to the Martin and Booker case, there was this taxi driver. He quickly became a hot suspect because his cab was seen in the vicinity of the crime scene that morning. So they questioned this driver of this taxi pretty hard, but eventually, you know, just nothing came of it. They let him go because they had no evidence to tie him to the case. So there was another tip, Gibbs, in this Booker Martin case, and it came from a man named Jerry Atkins, and he was Betty Jo Booker's band leader. So if you go back to part one, we talked about Betty Jo. She played saxophone in a band. We know that her saxophone was ultimately found, but it wasn't found for like 6 months after her murder. But in April, you know, way before they knew what was to happen with the saxophone, they actually arrested a man in Corpus Christi, Texas, that was trying to sell a saxophone to a music store. So apparently the guy walked into this music store and asked the salesperson if they wanted to buy an Alto Bundy saxophone, same type that Betty Jo had. And apparently this guy was very, very nervous. He was acting very strange. And the lady said, well, I need to get my manager. And when the manager came out from the back, the guy just ran out of the store. So the whole thing kind of played out very strangely. And because of that, the manager contacted the police, and the man was arrested a couple days later at a hotel. And apparently the police had found out that he'd purchased a .45 revolver from a pawn shop. So the sales girl from the store identified him as the man who tried to sell the saxophone. They never found a saxophone in his possession. But what they did find was a bag of bloody clothing in his hotel room.
Sounds suspicious to me.
Well, it's very suspicious. Now, the guy said that the blood was from a cut that he sustained on his forehead in a bar fight.
There you go.
But we know this isn't the guy. We know this isn't the saxophone. It's just very interesting because, number one, why was he so nervous? Why is he trying to sell a saxophone that he apparently doesn't have? And then he ends up buying a 45 revolver from a pawn shop. He's got a bag full of bloody clothes. So anyway, they grilled this guy for a number of days. Everything that he told the police checked out to be true. It's just a very strange story.
Yeah, it is.
So eventually the police have to come out and say that beyond a shadow of a doubt, they don't believe this guy has anything to do with it.
So they clear him.
Yeah, they clear him. And obviously it'll come out later that they find the saxophone anyway, but the guy just had a lot of weird stuff going on. Even without the saxophone.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised. I mean, every time we do some story on a serial killer, we always find some bizarre other folks in the same area.
All right, Gibbs. So we're getting into some of the better suspects that you see mentioned a lot in this case. All right, Gibbs. So we got to talk about Max Tackett again. And if you remember, folks, Max Tackett was one of the police officers that responded to the Starks home after the big shootout and that whole incident. And Max Tackett was actually a 33-year-old rookie officer. That's kind of unusual, a little bit.
A little bit.
Right, to start at that age.
Maybe second career.
Yeah, maybe it was.
Came back from the war.
Oh, that's really good. You're probably right on that. So Max Tackett, he started to see a pattern. And the pattern he noticed was that each time the Phantom Killer struck, there was a car that was reported stolen at one location and was later abandoned at another. So his theory, Gibbs, I believe, was that the Phantom was stealing a car to use in the commission of the crime or the murder and then dumping it. Which, if you think about it, is actually pretty smart.
It is.
Because you're not using your own vehicle, and as long as you're not leaving enough evidence for somebody to tie you to that car that you're only in for a brief time.
Well, it's not like they had DNA back then.
Well,
right?
Yeah, you're right. So and if somebody sees you or sees the car, they can't tie it to you. It's not your car. You've stolen it. So anyway, Max Tackett's got this theory. And on Friday, June 28th, he actually finds a car that had been reported stolen in a parking lot. And what he does, he stakes out the car and he's waiting for someone to come back to it. And someone does. It's a 21-year-old woman and he arrests her. So when questioned, the woman says that she had just married her husband in Shreveport, but he was currently in Atlanta, Texas, trying to sell another stolen car. And they were actually able to corroborate this, Gibbs, because they get a hold of the chief of police in Atlanta, Texas, and the guy tells Tackett that, yeah, there was a man that had recently tried to sell a stolen car to one of the citizens in Atlanta. Now, unfortunately, when this person was asked if he would be able to recognize the person selling the car, he said no. He wouldn't be able to. So Gibbs, Tackett eventually catches up with this man. And his name is Jules Swinney. But Swinney won't talk at all. So Tackett's got to go back to Jules' wife, Peggy, that he's already arrested. And Peggy starts talking like crazy. And she confesses in a whole lot of detail that her husband, Yule, is the Phantom Killer and that he killed Betty Jo Booker and Paul Martin. So, Gibbs, this is where, you know, it gets a little squirrely because by law, Peggy could not be made to testify against her husband, Yule.
How would you even know what she's saying is reliable?
Even without that, she would be considered a pretty unreliable witness. I mean, she was arrested with a stolen car. So she could testify against her husband for a number of reasons.
Yeah, she's trying to find, and she knows, I'm sure she's, you know, in that area, so she knows it's a hot topic. They're looking for this person, so why not put that heat on her husband if it gets her out of some issues with the police?
Yeah, but either way, you know, by law, she couldn't be made to testify anyway. So because of this, I mean, Yule is not arrested for murder. Now, what he is arrested for and sent to prison for is for car theft. But we got to dive a little deeper into this one because there is a whole bunch of circumstantial evidence that we have to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely there is.
Because we talked about Peggy being arrested with a stolen car. Well, that stolen car was the one that was reported stolen on the night of the Griffin and Moore murders. So it's not just any stolen car.
No. And to the point when Tackett caught up with Yule and chased him down, he yelled at the officer, "Don't shoot me." And he yelled back, the officer did, "Why would I shoot you?"
For stealing cars.
For stealing cars. And Yule says something like, "Don't play games with me because I know that you want me for something else." So what's that statement?
Yeah, so very strange,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's a strange statement to make.
Well, and to that point, you know, when Yule is in the police car, he asks another officer, you know, "What do you think they'll do to me for this?" Right? Kind of a vague question, but he follows it up with, "Will they give me the chair?" You don't ask somebody if you're going to get the chair for stealing cars. Nobody thinks they're going to get the chair for stealing cars.
No, that's another strange statement to make.
It is very strange. And so the officer responds, "You won't get much, maybe 5-10 years, something like that." They don't give you the electric chair for stealing cars. And again, this is when Yule says to this other officer, "You know you got me for more than just stealing cars."
Yeah, strange, man. You know, a lawyer talks to Peggy about how her husband's going to be held for murder. And then she says something like, "How did they find out?" So again, I mean, some interesting statements are being said.
Well, they're interesting, but it's also like these people are not very smart. I don't know, Gibbs. It's almost like they're giving out way more information than they should be giving out.
Yeah, to me, a lot of it doesn't make... I mean, to the point that, I mean, Peggy even takes some officers where they near the spot where they found Martin's car, and she walks them out to the woods a little bit. So the officers actually find a woman's heel print in that general area.
So again, you know, why is Peggy offering up all this information? Why is she leading the officers? That's the part I'm struggling with. I guess I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't know where the loyalty is to her husband. And then she talks about how her family and some other family members, they feel that he is the phantom killer. She's telling the police that. Again, what's the motive here for those type of statements?
Well, and it would make more sense to me if it was all Peggy. Right? If Yule wasn't saying anything about it and it was all Peggy trying to pin it on him, then you could make the case for she's got a motive to do it. But Yule is saying a bunch of weird stuff as well, right? The whole electric chair and you know you got me for more than just stealing cars. It's not just her upset with him trying to pin something on him.
Right.
There's more to it than that. But there's a lot more interesting stuff here, Gibbs. I mean, the police end up finding a work shirt in Yule's room that has the word Stark written in it. And to tie that to Virgil, in the front pocket of this shirt, there's some slag found. And that ends up matching samples that are found in Virgil's welding shop. I mean, this is some really good evidence.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
Yeah. In today's world, it'd be really strong, I would think.
I would think it would be. You know, but Yule owned a .32 Colt automatic.
But, you know, Yule's not saying anything. He's not defending anything. He's not, you know, saying I'm innocent. He's just not saying anything during this time.
Which to me is strange, because if I'm innocent, I'm going to shout it from the rooftop. You know, to just stay silent and not say you're innocent, or say, hey, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't do any of this.
Right.
That's, you know.
Yeah.
It's odd.
Makes you wonder. And to the point that even his wife, again, Peggy's giving information to the officers that the general public was not made aware of on some of these cases. So how does she know this information? So either Yule told her, or she knows somebody in the police department that's leaked it to her, right? It could only be those two things.
Or she was involved,
or
in some capacity as true. Well
yeah.
with Yule. So those are the things that kind of point towards Yule being involved. But there are some things that point away from it as well. Number one, his fingerprints didn't end up matching any of the prints from the Booker Martin crime scene.
No. And then on top of that, now Peggy's going to recant her statements.
Now, Yule eventually does deny being the Phantom. I don't know why he doesn't from the beginning, but he eventually would come out and deny it. And he never does make any type of real confession. I think a lot of law enforcement, they just weren't convinced that he was involved. I mean, I think the Texas Rangers, Sheriff Bill Presley, which we talked about in episode one, they all come out and say that they don't believe that Yul Swinney is the Phantom Killer. And to that point, it said that, you know, they had all these different police agencies that were doing the investigation, and they worked for 6 months to try to validate some of these things that Peggy had in her story about their whereabouts on different, you know, dates and things like that. At the end of it, they just could not say that she was telling the truth. I mean, one of the things that comes out is on the night of the murder of Booker and Martin, Peggy and Yule are sleeping in their car under a bridge near San Antonio. All right, Gibbs. So to wrap up Yule and Peggy, there's a lot there. And then there's a lot that kind of muddies the waters.
Typical rabbit hole.
Yeah. But I think a lot of people think that Yule Swinney is one of the better suspects. Would you say that?
Oh, absolutely.
You know, on the internet.
Yeah.
He's viewed as one of the...
A lot of buzz.
One of the better suspects. Now, the other one that you see a lot is a person named H.B. Duty Tennyson.
Duty.
I just like the name Duty.
Yeah.
Now, so I'm going to refer to him as Duty.
Duty.
From here on out. Now, we're talking about... His real name is Henry Booker Tennyson. But for some reason, he went by Duty. And I'm not sure. If I was picking my own nickname, it
Olympic
sure as
duty.
Hell wouldn't be Duty. So in November of 1948, right, this is a couple years after the murders, Duty is an 18-year-old freshman at the University of Arkansas. And he's found dead in his own bed at his home. One thing that comes out after his death is that he had purchased some cyanide on November 3rd. So that was just a couple of days before he died. And it was said that he was going to use it for rat poison. You know, I guess back then it was a lot easier to buy certain types of chemicals, obviously, than it is today.
Sure.
But when they found him dead, they also found a note. And the note read, "The opening to my box will be found in the following few lines. In a tube of paper is found, rolls on colors, and it is dry and sound. The head removes, the tail will turn, and inside is the sheet you yearn. Two bees mean a lot when they are together. these clues should lead you to it. What in the hell is that? It's like a riddle?
It's a riddle. He's a riddler. He is putting whoever finds this on a scavenger.
Like a quest.
A quest, yeah. All right.
So I guess Gibbs, ultimately, they figure out this riddle, and it leads them to a fountain pen.
And that fountain pen actually happened to be a brand called BB fountain pen. So that helps with the clue that he left.
Right. So two B's together.
Right.
It's actually kind of interesting if you think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a little hunt.
Now, on the cap of this pen, they find some poison, but they get to the note inside of the pen, and it contains some clues to the combination of a lockbox. So again, this is like a riddle leading to more clues, almost like you said, a scavenger hunt.
Yeah.
Is really what this guy is kind of leading them on.
He is. But I don't think the police are too entertained with this.
No, I mean, they're not kids. They don't want to go on a scavenger hunt. So they have the ability. They just break into the lockbox. Now, what they find inside this lockbox is a Viewmaster.
Oh, yeah, the old Viewmaster.
Right, like we had when we were kids.
Yeah, pretty cool.
And there's several rolls of film inside. And the film is like pictures of Mexico. And there's a stack of papers. None of that is important. What is important is under the stack of papers, there is a note. And the note is Duty confessing to the Texarkana killings. And the note reads, "Why did I take my own life? Well, when you committed two double murders, you would too. Yes, I did kill Betty Jo Booker and Paul Martin in the city park that night, and killed Mr. Starks and tried to get Mrs. Starks. You wouldn't have guessed it. I did it when Mother was either out or asleep, and no one saw me do it. For the guns, I disassembled them and discarded them in different places. When I am found, which has already been done, please give this typewriter to Craig," I guess Craig was his older brother, "and tell him that I hope that his child is a boy. It will help him in his work. Everything can go wherever you think it will do best, except for the Viewmaster, which will go to Belva Joe," whoever the hell Belva Joe is. "Please take my bankroll and give it to Daddy. I think it should go to him, and tell him I don't want the car now. Well, goodbye, everybody. See you sometime, if I make the grade, which will be hard for me to make." And this guy is something else. He's saying he's the Phantom, but he's not confessing to all the murders. He's confessed to Betty Jo Booker and Paul Martin and Virgil Starks.
Right.
But Gibbs, he hasn't said anything about Richard Griffin and Polly Ann Moore or the attacks on Jimmy Hollis or Mary Jean Larry.
If he actually did this, then that means there's another killer out there. If he just did this for fame, why wouldn't he have included the other ones? Right? I mean,
yeah, very, very strange, because you're right. You're dead.
Yeah.
You know you're dead. Nobody's going to find it unless you are dead.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is either true or not true, but either way, why not confess to them all?
Take it all, right?
Or don't do it at all.
Right.
Yeah. That's the part that's troubling me. So apparently, you know, he'd written a whole bunch of rough drafts with pencil. Then he had typewritten some other copies. I mean, he went as far as creating his own newspaper headlines talking about his body being found. I mean, this guy was really out there.
Yeah, I think he was definitely unstable.
You know, one of them read, "University of Arkansas student found dead." Another one was, "University of Arkansas student commits suicide." he had printed words on a sign that said, "Do not disturb, death in the making." I mean, these are just very bizarre things. And keep in mind, this is a kid. He's 18 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
And would have only been 16 at the time of the murders.
At the time of the murders, yeah.
And then he goes on to write his own epitaph. So he says, "Here lies H.B. Tennyson." He didn't put the duty in there that time. "Born February 12th, 1930. Died October 2nd, 1948. He committed suicide for the happiness of his family." He committed suicide for the happiness of his family. "May he rest in peace. Amen." Whew.
Yeah. He is just, I don't know what to say, man.
That line, I had to say it twice because I had to really, I'm really trying to take it in. I mean, anybody that honestly believes that their family would be happier if they weren't around.
Yeah. Not stable.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. So there was a whole bunch of other notes that they found. The problem that the police had is none of these other notes were dated, and they couldn't figure out what order that the notes were supposed to go in.
Yeah.
So they had a really hard time deciphering everything.
Very confusing and very contradicting for sure.
Yeah, and also keep in mind that the police and the sheriff and a bunch of different agencies would come out later and say they didn't know who the heck this kid was. He was never a suspect. He was never questioned. They had no idea who he was at all. They tapped Max Tackett to lead an investigation in Arkansas.
Well, and they run his fingerprints to see if they match anything at any of the crime scenes, and they don't get any hits. When I say hits, it's not like they run them through today through APHIS, right? But they're comparing them side by side to what they found on the crime scene.
Right.
And there's nothing matching up.
There's no match. Again, I hate to belabor the point on fingerprints, but you know, we don't know if the fingerprints they had were even the killer's. Right? Because we talked about Yul Swinney, his fingerprints not matching. We don't know obviously we don't know whose fingerprints they were, but we don't actually know that the fingerprints that they had that they were trying to match up to were the actual killers. They could have been somebody else that rode in the car. It could have been the car owner if the car was...
Right.
Because the car was stolen.
So they even find another note, right? That basically says, disregard any and every note you found up to this point.
Yeah, he says that these other notes are just thoughts that I had when I was thinking about possible reasons for taking my own life. One thing I do know, Gibbs, is this was a very unhappy kid. Because, you know, just like the comment about he's committing suicide for the happiness of his family. I mean, he goes on to say in other notes, you know, if I'm out of the way, all the rest of my family can get on with their own lives. Why could they not? Were they not getting on with their own lives while he was still alive?
Yeah,
was everybody else's life on hold because of him?
It's interesting. Just I don't really recall many 18-year-olds that still call their dad daddy. He refers to his parents as mother and daddy. Not mommy and daddy, not mother and father, but mother and daddy.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe that's a 1946 thing.
Maybe it is. I don't know.
But he keeps on talking about the fact that, you know, he didn't want anybody to have to worry about him. He didn't want his mom having to worry about him making good grades. He didn't want his daddy to have to spend any more money on his college. So I get the fact that people commit suicide. Well, when I say I get it, I understand that it happens. I don't understand why. But what I don't understand is why throw it in there that you're the phantom killer. You're laying out all these reasons why you want to kill yourself. Why throw the Phantom in there if you had nothing to do with it?
Yeah.
Just for posthumous notoriety?
I guess. And I think that's where you're going to find that this heads.
So the police end up talking to one of Duty's friends after he commits suicide. After the friend learns that in addition to committing suicide, he had also confessed to being the Phantom Killer. Well, this guy comes forward and says, there's no way he was the Phantom Killer. I mean, because I was with him on the night of when Virgil Starks died. We were at his own house, at Duty's house, playing cards between 7 and midnight. And on top of that, he says that night they both heard the news about Virgil Starks together. Duty had a couple of brothers. And his brothers would come out and say that the confession and the suicide, these were all induced by reading too many comic books. That's what they blamed it on. They said he didn't know anything about guns, didn't know how to care for any weapons or guns, didn't hunt, didn't shoot, anything like that. The other thing they said that any guns that he would have had access to, I guess maybe in the Tennyson home, none of them were the same caliber used in the Phantom murders, right? Yeah. So none of them were .32.
Right. And then his brother even says that it wasn't until the summer of 47 that he taught him how to drive. So, I mean, if these murders happened in 46, I mean, he wasn't even driving until 47. So how could he have been the Phantom?
So, Giz, one other thing we got to talk about is this Duty guy. Apparently, he was 6'3", pretty tall. He weighed 130 pounds.
Yeah, that's a pretty wiry guy.
Why? I mean, that's like pretty stick thin, really, if you think about it. But the only reason I bring it up is because, you know, in the first episode, when we were talking about some of the murders, the theory was, at least in one of them for sure, that one of the girls, I can't remember which one now, Gibbs, but she was shot and killed outside of the car, but placed on the back seat. At 130 pounds, I'm not even sure if you're picking hardly anybody up. I don't know.
Yeah, well, first assault, I mean, the female victim talks about how strong the Phantom was with the impact. I mean, she said it just knocked him down. And then remember the male victim, he was lucky to survive the beating. I can't imagine 100 and now maybe I'm wrong. So I'm just not sure. I don't believe a 6'3", 130 pound person is going to be able to do that type of beating that male victim took in the first case.
And I think the biggest thing is there was talk about how powerful. There was talk about that this Phantom Killer was powerful.
Right.
Physically. I'm not... 130 pounds is... I mean, there are fighters that are... But I'm not getting that from Duty.
No.
Right? He's not an MMA UFC fighter that just happens to weigh 130 pounds.
But they're not 6'3 either.
Yes, you're right.
You know, they're compact, you know, 130 pounds, so...
So, Gibbs, I would think it's safe to say that Yule and Duty are probably the two most talked about suspects. But there are some others out there. You know, on Wednesday, May 8th, there was an announcement that an escaped German prisoner of war was considered a suspect. This guy was described as a 24-year-old. He weighed 187 pounds. Brown hair, blue eyes, and this guy stole a car in Arkansas, and then he attempted to buy some ammunition in Oklahoma. So on Tuesday, May the 7th, there was a 45-year-old man named Herbert Thomas, and he was flagged down by a hitchhiker in the town of Kilgore. The man said that he needed a ride to Henderson because his mother was ill, and he offered the guy $5 to take him. When they got near the town of Henderson, the hitchhiker pulled out a pistol and told Thomas to keep driving or he would kill him, like he killed five people in Texarkana. Specifically, he mentioned Paul Martin and Betty Jo Booker by name. The man told Thomas that he was not done killing. He planned on killing a whole bunch more people. And he also said he was going to return to Texarkana and kill Paul Martin's father. Very specific.
Yeah.
The problem was, what he didn't know was that Paul Martin's father was already dead. That doesn't really mean anything. He may not have known that if he really was the Phantom.
Right.
So what ended up happening is they stopped in Lufkin and the hitchhiker got out. He stole the $5 that he had given to Thomas for the ride, and he took another $3 on top of that to boot. And he told Thomas to drive back to Kilgore and not to follow him. And if he did follow him, he'd trail him down and kill him. So Thomas gets back to Kilgore, reports the incident to the police, and he described this man as 5'8", 130 pounds. Man, why does everybody weigh 130 pounds?
Yeah, I don't know. Not a lot of food back then.
I guess it was a little malnourished.
Yeah.
Going on back then. Thought he was about 27 or 28 years old, had red hair, wore trousers, and had on a GI jacket. All right, Gibbs, so let's end this episode by talking about some false confessions. I mean, you're always going to have false confessions, especially in any big time case. Happens all the time. And the police dealt with a bunch of them in this case. There was a man in Shreveport that confessed to the crimes. And actually, he was arrested because he was telling the story of how he killed the people in Texarkana. And what he didn't realize is he was talking to a news reporter in a bar.
Because you know it's got to be true when you're in a bar drinking.
Well, and the newspaper reporter actually offered him a fifth of whiskey if he would tell him the whole story.
There you go.
And so I guess the guy tells him a story when the police officer gets to the bar because he's called. He knows who the guy is. He's an alcoholic and he's confessed to the killings a whole bunch of times. They already know who he is.
Yeah.
And the police officer calls him out by name and he says, you know, you didn't kill those people. And the guy says, no, I know I didn't kill him, but hell, I got a fifth of whiskey out of it. So it was like maybe a game he played, right, or something to see how much alcohol he could get for telling his story.
Free booze.
Now, if you go back to Max Tackett, he would say that there were 9 different people along the way that had tried to convince him that they were the Phantom. But in every case, there's no way that they could have been. You know, their stories didn't line up with the facts that the police knew about the case. Because you got to think, there was a lot of facts that they didn't release.
Right.
And that's done intentionally.
Sure.
Because that's how you can corroborate a story, if there's some facts that are not released to the public.
So clearly these 9 individuals that tried to confess couldn't put all the puzzle together.
No, I think what they could put together was what was already out there, like in the papers.
Right.
What they couldn't put together is the 3, 4, 5 really important facts, however many there are,
that they should have known if they were the killer.
Yes, that the police always hold back.
Yeah.
And I think the last one, Gibbs, is there was a confession by this guy in Los Angeles, of all places. And this one was a really strange one because he said he'd been in a coma and he said he thought he might be the Phantom. He said, I got out of this coma and I know I've been running from something, but I don't know what it is. Maybe murder.
Yeah.
That's what he says. He says, but if I did kill those people in Texarkana, I want to know. And if I didn't kill them, then I want to go on with my life. And actually, he said he wanted to be a stuntman in Hollywood.
Okay.
And so he goes into the paper, the Los Angeles Examiner, and he's talking to the reporter. And he says, I want to sell you my story of how I was the Texarkana Phantom. And he says, but I want you to give me $5 for it. And I want you to give me an hour head start. I'll put all the information in this envelope. You give me the $5. I take off. You open the envelope in an hour. This is what this guy's telling him. And so the reporter opens it up and reads it. And he calls the police and they come. And basically what it says is that this guy was in a Texarkana theater watching a war movie. There was a group of people in there that were saying some negative things about the war, and it pissed him off.
Yeah, because he was a veteran.
Yeah, he was a veteran. And he followed them home, and he killed them within a period of 3 days. So the police actually arrest this guy. They track him down, and they arrest him. So like we said, the man claimed to have been in a coma for several weeks. And he said when he woke up on May the 3rd, his rifle was missing. And he heard about the Texarkana killings, and he thought that the description matched himself. So he's basically, from that point, thinking that he's the suspect. And so he hitchhiked all the way to Los Angeles to get away from the police.
Yeah.
Because he felt like he was running from murder charges, is basically what he said. Come to find out, he'd been discharged from the Air Force for mental instability. And so the chief of police comes out and says, I feel that this man is a mental case. That's his words, not mine. He goes on to say the Texarkana killings could have been the work of a mental case. And so far, at that point, it's possible that this guy could have done it. He just says, we have absolutely no facts. But I think the Texas Rangers would come out later and they would say that basically they kind of tore apart some of this guy's story and none of it.
Well, and it just goes back to what we always say with these unsolved, man. It's just a lot of rabbit holes. You can chase them and chase them. And sometimes you know that you can stop, and other times you're just not sure if it really is leading somewhere or not. And I think you got a lot of rabbit holes in this one.
Yeah,
right?
I think you got a lot of weird ones. I mean, the Yule Swinney is very interesting. The Duty Tennyson one is just warped and interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I think the Yule is probably lends more towards the
top suspect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think if you looked at all the facts, there's more things pointing towards him than anybody else, for sure. Right. I think Duty's probably the more interesting.
Just intriguing, but I don't think he had anything to do with it at all.
I don't think he did either, but he's way out there. So in closing, Gibbs, you know, we always talk about how likely some of these unsolved are to be solved. I'm not thinking this one's as likely, right? It's much older.
Well, most of the folks that would have been around that time, if they haven't passed, I'm assuming that they're, you know, pretty elderly now. And
yeah, no doubt.
The recall won't be as fresh as it would have been.
Yeah, I think as time goes by, anybody that most people that would have knowledge or, you know, either already passed away or are getting,
yeah,
you know, close to.
And so, if the killer was between 30 and 50 years old, clearly the killer is passed on anyway.
You don't know that. It could be 110 years old. All right. So that is the final wrap up of the Phantom Killer. Another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. You know, for Mike Ferguson
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.